All right, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back. Let's see, it looks like we're starting to see a small amount of attrition here. I see some empty chairs. Hopefully people are not feeling the weather, but just remember, after today, a small thought, only 2 more weeks till spring break. So hopefully that fills you with a sense of anticipation and joy and laying on a sunny beach somewhere and hearing the waves crash in the background as someone hands you a nice drink. Or it could also feel a sense of queasy calm, uncertainty as you think, boy, I should be further on my outlines right now. It's sort of a personality test there. Just a general sense, I do want to remind you, though, this semester is going by amazingly quickly. So if you want to talk, if you want to get some sense of things that are going on, feel free. My office hours are, of course, Tuesday afternoons, but also I'm glad to schedule another time. And please don't forget, you have an amazing resource with Alex in the back corner, waving to you gently. The beacon in the darkness, the guiding light to get you to shore. So a couple of very quick announcements. Number one, just can't resist pointing out, for those of you who like to do good in the world, the Public Interest Law Organization's silent auction is, I believe, the week after next, March 6th. So it's a great opportunity to bid on interesting things to do and all sorts of opportunities. Just make sure it was on your calendar and you had a chance to see it. Number two, for this class, keep in mind that the judge's guest lecture is our first class after spring break, which means I'm going to need your questions to the judges before you go on spring break. So according to the website, remember, I've asked that you get them to me by the Monday after next. So you've got about a little over a week to think about what you would ask Judge Lee Rosenthal or former Justice Brett Busby if you're sitting down with them with a cup of coffee, and they could answer any question you had on how to interpret statutes that would help you in this class. And I always like to take the questions in advance and present them to the judges and let them think and choose which one they want to answer first. And I do have a small tradition of giving a prize to the question they choose to answer first to the student who asked it. The prize is a mystery, but I always promise it'll at least be interesting. So with that, any questions? Any things you guys want to announce, bring to the attention of your classmates before we dive into the discussion today? All right. Then if you would indulge me for a 1 minute detour, and this is not part of our class, but I just wanted to share with you, part of the joy of being a lawyer is discovering things you never knew. And I just found out this morning about an interesting case called Sterling versus Constantine. Have y'all heard of this one? Noah's nodding his head yes. You're nodding at something else. Okay. Well, thank you. 1932 Supreme Court decision involving the state of Texas, when Texas decided to pass a new regulation limiting the amount of oil and gas that surface operators could take from their states, which didn't go over very well. There were threats to dynamite wells, according to some folks. So the governor of Texas called out the Texas Rangers and declared martial law, and the whole premise was that he declared an emergency. Sound familiar? And the emergency was appealed straight up to the Supreme Court, where Charles Evan Hughes, was told he couldn't decide this case because the governor's decision as to what is an emergency was solely within the power of the executive, no judicial review. So I recommend it for you just as it's the first time I ever heard of this case, despite all my practice. It's sort of fun to watch it pop up into discussion now. I was just curious what you think the decision of the Supreme Court was back in 1932 with that situation. Would the governor of Texas win or lose in saying, courts, go away, you bother me? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs up. Okay, thumbs up in what way? Sole power, and they couldn't review it. Okay. And Brian, you were doing thumbs down?
That was mostly hopeful.
Hopeful. Hopeful I wouldn't notice which way your thumb was going, or?
No, hopeful that the Supreme Court overturned it and said there's
no. Okay. Well, I would love to leave you in suspense and just announce it next week, but I assume some of you have already Googled it since we started talking. Short answer is the Supreme Court found there was judicial review of the executive's determination. Is there gloating going on here? So I will try and dig up more information about the case. The idea of the Texas Rangers patrolling the oil fields of East Texas because of threats to dynamite the wells because the owners were told they couldn't pump to their heart's delight, leading to a national, an emergency declaration, which led to Supreme Court review, is just too good to pass up. There's a movie in here somewhere. But I just want to bring it to your attention just because it sounds like a lot of fun. And please do not mention this Professor Rave, even though it is a classic con law question. So with that in mind, we turn back to statutory interpretation. And so, as always, I usually start with a quick look back. But I'm sure you guys would like to have something other than my voice starting every single class. So I want to try something a little bit different. What I want to do is take just 3 to 5 minutes and ask one of you to do a seance with me. I want you to channel Justice Scalia. I want you to say in a persuasive way to convince your classmates why textualism is the right way to go. And that's the best way to capture some of our discussion from our last class. So who would like to be the medium for our discussion? This is what I will not, I would like to have a volunteer rather than try and point the finger at somebody. Well, all right, Byron, thank you. I never would have thought you would sort of have this spiritual vibe with Justice Antonin Scalia.
Practical Magic is my favorite movie.
Oh. Oh boy, if you're making obscure movie references, you're really hitting my sweet spot. I'm going to stop there. Let's keep going. So, persuade a class full of your skeptical classmates, your colleagues, why they should ignore legislative history, why text matters.
I probably have another intention, but I'm going to just frame it in a way that doesn't seem racist or homophobic.
All right, you're not being very persuasive to start here.
On the top.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, the law governs, not intent. You can never tell what, it's not our purpose to discern what the legislature intends, only what they've actually enacted. There's multiple levels, so the only people you can actually trust is the text. The plain meaning is the alpha and the omega of statutory interpretation. We're supposed to determine what an ordinary English speaker would draw from it at the time, not at the moment that it was enacted because things change. The legislative history also should not be used to determine intent because things go through multiple changes. And the only thing that we can actually depend on is what they've actually enacted.
Okay. And that's a very nice summary of what your value proposition is. Let me change the rules. You guys can push back. Ask him questions as to why or why you disagree on that position. Do you believe him? You're all persuaded? That only took 30 seconds. Brian, somehow I knew you would be jumping up here.
So you're saying that in order to find the law, we're requiring Congress to essentially create bulletproof statutes and not look to any of their meaning, any of the governing forces that are pushing the law. So essentially what you're saying is, instead of looking to the elected representatives craft the law, instead we're going to pay all deference to the dictionary. Is that right?
Well, we're not just talking about the dictionary, we're talking about the meaning at the time to the people. We're not voting in, so we're not meant to discern what legislative intent is. We're only meant to figure out what the actual text means in the context of whatever's going on at the time. And if the legislator wants to make any changes, we're free to do that, but we can't just discern what the intent is at that time, and especially not the intent of the legislator now, probably not the community of the text as it was enacted.
Well, I got 2 points to that. So we've purposefully made it incredibly difficult to create law, right? On a federal level, it has to have bicameral approval, and it has to go through both. So when Congress, in their infinite wisdom, actually does make a mistake, which of course never happens, you're saying that the only mechanism to fix that is to re-craft laws that have to go through an incredibly cumbersome process, and that is the only relief offered upon the population.
Well, as the Constitution says, our job is merely to determine if something is constitutional or not. So the reason why it's so difficult to go through that system is because there's checks and balances. sure that there aren't any stupid mistakes. So if there is any mistake that's so amazing and huge that it actually has an impact on the daily life of the American citizen, then of course I would assume that it is a job of the legislature to make those changes, not ours. That's not what we're supposed to do.
Well, Mr. Scalia, in this argument, or in one of these cases, you actually hinted at the fact that you don't agree with the outcome, that the outcome is kind of despicable, yet you have to pay so much deference to the text. The only remedy to what you said, or hinted at, that you don't agree with, is to go through an entire new legislative session, re-legislate the law, and until then, there is no remedy for the... But my other point is this. Modernly, we tend to use words that, in a way that could be contrary to the dictionary. One of my points would be, if you took a poll of everyone in the class about what the word literally means, you would get an array of answers. And that is the definition of an ordinary meaning. The dictionary, therefore, can't be the definition of the ordinary meaning because we don't all use it that way. Instead, we've elected representatives from a majority. You have to have a 51%, so that is representative of a majority opinion. Why is that? Why, when those representatives speak for us as they've been elected, why is that not the ordinary meaning of a word as opposed to what's written in a dictionary?
Just interject, you use the word literally, you said we have different meanings for it. The meaning of plain meaning was only one actual meaning for it. So, to tell you literally, of course, we've looked to other topics such as legislative intent, the various meanings and ways that we can broaden it or narrow it to where, like, national cover statutes that are enacted. And I think that the only way to actually ensure that we do what the Constitution determined for us to do, which is the text that created us as a body, as justices, Justice Ginsburg, is to follow what it says. And if there's going to be any changes, then they have to go through the entire process to get to it. It's the reason why we have checks and balances to ensure that there aren't any, like, random mistakes, like, I don't know, wall building, you know, big emergency, stuff like that. You know, I'm sorry, that wasn't a Scalia type of comment.
You need to work on your channeling skills, Byron. All right, at this point, the podium has a small set of lights, the little red lights coming on, which means time's up. And excellent job, both of you. I'm not sure exactly who you were channeling, but I liked them. So with that in mind...
Justice Bounce.
Oh, you know I'm going to ride that one the rest of the semester. All right. Very quickly, show of hands. Who's persuaded by the ghost of justices past, Justice Scalia? All right. Who's persuaded by the ghost of justices future, Justice Bounce? All right. Who didn't raise their hand at all because they're just wrestling with their soul at the moment? Noah, of course. Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much, guys. Hey, that was a great way to remind everybody what we've been talking about and also preview what today's discussion is going to be. Now, I will note, both of you focused really on practical implementation questions. How does this theory actually work when you try to apply it? When perhaps I might suggest the place to start is why people think it's right. What's the fundamental value proposition here, to use terrible Bauer College speak? Now, before I do, remember the spectrum. We started off with legal process, which is potentially driven by a look to the process that generates statutes to put emphasis on purpose as the lodestar for interpreting the language of the statute. And then we move to soft textualism, TVA versus Hill and Justice Berger, talking a little bit about the fact that you look to the text, and if the text is clear, you go with the text, even if the result is unpalatable, even if it's questionable. Why do we call it soft? Because it doesn't rule out other non-legislative sources of meaning. For example, you can use legislative history under the soft textualist approach, but usually only when it corroborates your interpretation of the text or the text is ambiguous and you're in a position of trying to find out what that meaning is because there is no clear, predominant, ordinary meaning. So you can see the arc bending towards now new textualism, which was our discussion today, which we've just distilled and captured in our Ouija board exercise. Now, what is new textualism? Why? What are we talking about here? And what is the value? Why do people think so passionately it's right? And the key thing here, I'll suggest to you, just to get your thinking going, is everything you've been taught so far in law school is wrong, except this class. Common law. Common law approach in torts, in contracts, in your other subject matter doctrinal classes puts the judge in the role of trying to identify the outcome of disputes in a way that accounts for the totality of circumstances and precedent in the past to give clear, relatable, enforceable, justifiable rules that apply in a common law context. The judge plays a central role in creating that law. They make the right call. Statutes, according to Scalia and the New Textualists, do not work that way. That is a fundamentally anti-democratic position if you're looking at statutes. Statutes are the law, not common law, not some soft, nebulous sense of what judges think the law should be. You have to go with what the legislature says. And the only thing that's the law is the language that survives the gauntlet of the process. As Justice Pounds mentioned, we have bicameralism, we have presentment. That language is the only thing that speaks to the law. So when we interpret it, we have to look at what the meaning of those words are on the page, not what someone thought on the well of the floor, not what someone put in a committee report, not what some staffer wrote in a Q&A to a witness in a committee hearing. So it is very much focused on the reasons laws are laws as the outcome of democratic processes, and it limits what is a valid source of that authority. So does that make sense to everyone? I feel like I unintentionally started channeling Scalia myself. All right, so what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at A Clash of the Titans, another obscure bad movie reference. Hey, we can argue about that one. But I have to like any movie that has Laurence Olivier say, release the Kraken.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So anyway, how did I get onto that one? We're seeing A Clash of the Titans, namely Stevens, Justice Stevens, who is the leading proponent of a more purpose-driven, pragmatic style of interpretation, who frequently clashed with Justice Scalia, who, when he assumed the bench in 1986, was a very strong proponent of this focused textualist approach. And we have two big cases that highlight it in an interesting way. Because in one, the majority is written by Stevens and Scalia is objecting. And the other, the roles are reversed. So what I want to do is take a look at each of those two cases, and then at the end of class, compare and contrast and see what big questions we can extract from them, and some sort of recurring themes we're going to see as to how these two theories of statutory interpretation play against each other. So with that in mind, our two cases. First one is Chisholm v. Romer. And here, I unfortunately have to leave volunteerism behind, and I'm going to go to the usual process of asking for someone to elucidate the process for us. So Courtney, could you help us out on this one? Mm-hmm. And Courtney, I'm going to be obnoxious to start. You're going to need to project.
Okay.
I suspect some folks here are leaning forward, anticipating your words with eager abandon. So. Okay.
That no voting qualification or prerequisite to voting standard practice or procedure shall be imposed or applied by any state or political subdivision to deny or abridge the right of any citizen.
Okay.
And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure we're all keeping up with each other. Is everyone here familiar with the concept of multi-member districts and how they work with terms of vote dilution? Just real briefly, notice you're absolutely correct. The fight was over multi-member districts, but notice the comparison was other folks were elected by single districts. And the single district could be crafted such a way that you may have a majority-minority population here of 60%, but if they're 1% in the others, single-member districts, you can elect someone who's representative of your background, your ethnicity. But if you combine them into a multi-member district, which they did for two of the positions, this dilution of all the other votes means that your majority-minority becomes a permanent minority and never has a voice electing someone who's representative of their background, of their constituency. So there's actually a very fundamental issue here, which is playing fair in the voting process. This is not a technicality. This goes to the heart of what the Voting Rights Acts are all about. So with that in mind, may I suggest to you, do y'all know how Texas Supreme Court justices are elected? One district, the state, border to border. So you can see the issue here in terms of electing judges, which I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead on you a little bit, actually can strike home fairly closely here, can't it? So with that in mind, what were they objecting to?
So basically, the big kind of contention was whether or not judicial elections were included in what they were bringing action for.
Well, no. What I will ask you in just a second is, let's always start with the text. What's the statute we're talking about? What's the language they're fighting over? And while she's doing that, I'm curious. This is for my information, just a poll. How many of you think it is appropriate to elect judges in a popular election, like we do in Texas and the majority of states? Okay. How many of you think that it is inappropriate and we should appoint judges for either limited or lifetime terms? Really? So it's about an even split. In prior years, it's been overwhelmingly against elections. So you guys you're giving a different perspective here. I'm curious how this class discussion is going to go today. So what language are we talking about here? So I want to make sure you subtly but persuasively emphasized a word. You said "and" with a little bit of, I thought, oomph. Okay? So I assume you'll be coming back as to why you thought the word "and" is important there.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have two things. You said that what is the importance if you end up being able to invoke either of the clause of 2B? Why does it matter? If judges are included in the second clause here, what happens? No, that's all right. I'm trying to be helpful. I'm not trying to mess up your chain of thought here. But I'm curious, have y'all talked yet about equal protection litigation in your con law class? All right. One of the key things about remedies under that equal protection provisions is that you have to typically show specific intent. I meant to discriminate against you because of your race or your ethnic background or religious beliefs. So the concern was, under the Voting Rights Act, do I have to show specific intent, or can I just simply show, regardless of what was inside my noggin, I ended up never electing someone of a minority status or of a protected status? And do the numbers give you enough? A disparate impact, a substantive disparity. That's what we care about here. If I look at the slate of judges elected under this process, and every single one of them are middle-aged white males going back 100 years, is that enough? Or do I have to actually find this smoking email? Does that make sense for everyone? All right, so now, once again, I have hogged your spotlight. So you've mentioned the language. What happens now?
Just what happens next?
Well, let me start with my favorite question. Who wins?
Basically, they say that Congress's choice of the word representatives, like the people win in this case.
I'm sorry, that's awfully nebulous. Don't the people always win if justice is served?
I guess the people bringing action.
Is that a way of saying plaintiff?
Yes.
Okay, so what does that mean? Who wins? The people and the minorities who live in this district who want judges who look like them? Or does the state win saying judges, pshaw?
The people and the minority.
Right. Justice Stevens says this second clause means you can look at disparate impacts in determining whether a voting rights claim can be raised against judicial elections. All right, so we've kind of blocked it out. Now we want to look under the hood. How did Justice Stevens get there? What's his statutory interpretive analysis here? Notice it's not con law. It's pure statutory interpretation.
So he kind of rejects the construction that Congress has chosen the word representative as evidence of congressional intent to exclude like the vote dilution claims involving general elections. The court kind of says that if Congress had such an intent, they would have made it explicit in the statute to exclude those judicial elections, or at least some of the members would identify or mention it at some point, because there's this really big kind of legislative history behind it, and nothing ever talks about excluding those, you know, kind of judicial elections.
So according to Justice Stevens, it needs to say except judges if you want to exclude judges. Okay, so silence speaks intent in this situation? It's like failing to include ministers in a list of excluded occupations in the Alien Importation of Labor Act and Holy Trinity Church? Okay, we could come back to that. So far, though, you haven't pointed to me to anything in the text itself that supports his case, his conclusion. You just told me the statute doesn't say judges. Are we done? We go home? Have a piña colada? I'm thinking of spring break, I'm sorry.
Kind of goes on to talk about how those two things, the opportunity to participate and elect representatives, how they're kind of inextricably linked. Mm-hmm. Like they're all kind of one process. So it would make sense to apply the first, or to apply judicial elections to the first part and not the second part.
So essentially, it's a logical consistency argument.
Right.
And again, that's just coined in the way that he cannot conceive as a judge sitting on the bench of a situation where you can have a remedy under one, but not a remedy under the other.
Right. He says that the statute doesn't kind of create two separate and distinct rights, but it's just kind of one.
Okay. And his rationale for that's, I mean, where's his authority for saying something like that? Other than that's how he understands the words to work.
He kind of says that it would distort the plain meaning of the sentence, so he does kind of bring in plain meaning as well as kind of the legislative history.
Okay, so we have omission, logical consistency, and then plain meaning of what words? Drill down. Unfortunately, statutory interpretation is all about the details. Which words are we drilling on?
He says that
so this case turns on the word and?
Sorry.
It just turns on the word and? That's it? No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm not badgering you, I promise. I just want to make sure that's a rather big statement.
I think so.
Okay, is there any other word that's planted in the language that might help bolster the case?
The word
so,
kind of encompass everyone who is elected by.
You determine the scope of the chosen word by the differing scope of alternative words that could have been plugged into the same space.
Right, and they included candidate, I think, in other parts of the act, so they were kind of able to distinguish the fact that they put representative here and candidate in other places. And then I think they talked about how.
So again, that's a statutory consistency argument. Okay. Keep going.
I think they talked about how
Okay, we'll come back to that one then. Again, the first step of any statutory construction, no matter which end of the spectrum you're on, purpose or literal or textual, is the text. So I want to make sure, is there any other words besides and that we can seize on to squeeze meaning out of the statute that supports Justice Stevens? And by the way, I see a hand. I can't tell if Noah's just controlling his urge to speak or if he's... That's interesting. I agree. That's an interesting argument. I'm just not. Did it surface at all in the case analysis?
I thought maybe I skipped too fast, but I thought Justice Stevens was saying if this is two separate things, then it's got to be less opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's a Y instead of an IES is interpretive grist for the mill, from your perspective. It's significant that he uses Y instead of IES in the statute. Okay. All right, that's another possibility. Any others? Hey, what about... This is earlier in the statute. I didn't write it down because Courtney didn't mention it, but... The right to vote shall not be constrained, and it gets the rest of the language to be. Any word in there that kind of gives you a weather vane as to what's going on here that Justice Stevens points to? Interesting. I have to admit, those of you who have philosophy majors are probably starting to feel a little bit at home, or maybe linguistics majors in the classroom. According to Justice Stevens, the use of the single unitary word "the" implies an indivisible unitary right, and that essentially there's not two different statutory guarantees separated by the word "and," but the fact that they are two halves of the same coin, of the same "the" right to vote. But again, notice the hallmark here is a close focus on the actual words of the statute, even ones that we glide over without even noticing when we read normally, and the structure of the sentences and grammatical choices using words "and" or "or." We're going to talk about next week choices between "shall" and "may," which may bring back memories of contracts. The language, if that's your starting point, means that we're always going to start with a very close, almost atomistic look at the language. All right, so Courtney, once again, I've been a very, very bad friend and host. We've only got about, I think, halfway through Justice Stevens' analysis. Is there anything else you'd like to add that sort of brings his case home? Well, in a way, you've already touched base on that, haven't you? Statutory consistency. If judge elections are included in Section 5, it seems a bit illogical for Congress to carve them out of Section 2B. And it's clear, despite the fact that there has been prior case law saying one person, one vote doesn't apply to judicial elections, that Section 5 had been consistently interpreted to cover judge elections. So I'm going to chuckle evilly and ask you to hold that thought because I'm going to come back to you at the end of class. Does it matter if it's consistent? What is the importance of consistency in reading the terms of a statute? Why do we care if a word means one thing in one section but something different in another section? And what's the risk if we choose to unmoor ourselves of that sense, of that importance of consistency? Right?
I'm drawn to the line of Scalise when he says that you should be able to look at the text and know essentially what behavior is required of you. If you're required to kind of use a sliding scale every time a word is used, it's less clear.
Mm-hmm. So, Courtney, you both are going to come back to at the end of class, because I think we're talking about some very fundamental value propositions that underlie textualist approaches to the case. But I'll also say Scalia is famous for writing a case decision, which we will not cover in this class, where he reached the exact opposite conclusion. So I hear you. I think you've got something important there, but I want to save that for sort of giving us a big picture where we leave this behind. Okay, so anything else? Courtney, were there different versions of the statute, the Voting Rights Act, prior to this one that say something to what it means now? Where does some of this language in 2B come from? No, but put it this way. In the original language, remember we started our whole class in the great Civil Rights Act battle and the filibuster, and that LBJ said the first thing he was going to do is get a strong Voting Rights Act in the books after the Civil Rights Act, because he lost that fight on the floor of the Senate. It got amended out. So this originally was passed after the Civil Rights Act. And we have the original language at the beginning of the opinion. And here's the hallmark I suggest to everybody, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what Justice Stevens said was that original language was deemed to cover judges. The judicial interpretations, the way it was applied, it was undisputed that originally Section 2 was designed to cover judicial elections as well. And then, remember how I started our discussion on con law? You had the court later decided you had to show specific intent, and essentially gutted the language of the original provision. In response, Congress added this language to overrule that Supreme Court interpretation. So they also cribbed, plagiarized, stole the language and part of 2B from the dissent in that decision that gutted the original language by Justice White. Now, why are we wandering down the labyrinth here? Two things. There's not only statutory consistency, there's also statutory history, not legislative history. Legislative history is basically psychoanalyzing what legislators were thinking by reading their statements on the floor. Statutory history is where you look at the language of the statute as it changes over time and how it's amended and what those changes on the plain meaning of the language reflect of Congress's will. The other, and we tend to forget this because textualism is all about what the words say and avoiding common law, don't forget precedent matters. I'm sorry, guys, on this side, but I'll try to repeat this or take a picture for you. I know it's hard to see through the podium. We had Supreme Court decisions interpreting this language. Those are valid grist for the mill, even for textualists. In understanding what that language means, the court pays attention to its prior rulings on language. They don't just pull out the dictionary and read the text anew every time. Does that make sense for everybody? So you can see there's a toolkit developing here. Certain things that Justice Stevens feels is fair and appropriate to deploy in trying to find an interpretation of the statute that works, that accomplishes what it's supposed to do. Now, with that in mind, is there anything else you'd throw in there? And that's That's not a leading cross-examination question. I'm genuinely asking, is there anything else that you think is germane and important before we leave Justice Stevens' opinion behind? Absolutely. So in a sense, it's not only structural inconsistency, it's also logical inconsistency. And to a certain extent, while Congress may be free to be logically and structurally inconsistent, you'd think they'd be overt about it rather than bury it like a landmine inside ambiguous language. The dog that didn't bark, which we'll be getting to in a little bit. Okay? So this is just the majority. This is one of the early clashes, though, where Scalia went hammers and tongs against what was really sort of the standard approach to interpreting statutes at the time. So in brief, and I hate to do this to you, Courtney, but could you just give us a distillation of Justice Scalia, because I want to save time as well for the West Virginia U versus Casey decision. Well, that's a nice distillation right there.
He says that the court uses an expectation about what the statute must mean absent particular phenomena. So he said that the court kind of draws on the fact that something isn't there to interpret the words of the statute. Mm-hmm. Fulfill their own expectation.
So our first step here, the omission of language he views as not appropriate.
Yes.
That's the judge saying, gosh, I wish that was in there. But the fact that it's not there must mean something.
Right.
Okay.
Then he also says that judges aren't representatives by the meaning of the dictionary.
Okay. How so?
He says,
if judges are elected, why are they not representatives?
He says that using the kind of popular election definition means that it could apply to references the All-Star baseball team,
mm-hmm.
and says that means that they would be representatives too. So it seems like he's saying...
Can I pause? That's a rather important point. Who here doesn't believe Jose Altuve is representing Houston when he's on the All-Star team? Oh, no! Leave! You cannot stay in this classroom! I'm sorry, go ahead. What's your rationale for that? All right. We're going to have a talk at some point this semester about baseball. I'll just simply say at some points I have actually the prize for the best question asked in for that judges chose first. In prior years, I've actually given one of my season tickets to the Astros, which is behind third base, about 10 rows back. So you can razz and boo the visiting team to your heart's delight. So I don't know how we got onto that one either. Okay. If I could, Courtney, you've captured some important things. Let me sort of pick two quick things for our time runs too low. The first paragraph of Scalia's opinion, I think you've touched on, but I want to make sure everyone captures that. Isn't Scalia saying this is a case about the process of interpretation? He thinks that it was pretty settled law the way you did this. And the process, according to Scalia and his dissent, is pretty straightforward. You start with the ordinary meaning of the language in its textual context. That's it. And then once you have that in hand, you can modulate it with some judicial canons of construction that I'm going to delightfully pull you guys through the thicket of over the next couple of weeks, starting next week. But at the end of the day, if those canons do not give a signal that conflicts with that ordinary meaning, you're done. Now, I will pause here. Those of you who read that first paragraph closely, notice there's no citations. There's no authority. There's no grounding laid out as to why Scalia thinks this is the accepted dogma for how to interpret statutes. So I would suggest to you it's given with a sense of confidence and certain verve, but it's actually a positioning opening for the debate. Now, having said that, point number two, Courtney very ably pointed out that the first recourse was the word representative. What does it mean? And the answer for a textualist is the ordinary meaning is usually found in dictionaries. So with that in mind, the word representative is defined in the dictionary. Which one did he cite?
If you look in the notes, he cites Webster's, but then later in the notes, it's kind of interesting because he cites one from the 50s, in this case it's in the 80s,
but that's just kind of. So if you have multiple dictionaries, which one do you choose?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a pocket dictionary they issued to World War II soldiers around the same vintage. This is the American Heritage Dictionary that they still sell on the bookshelves. This one reflects what we currently understand the words to mean. This is a historical meaning at the time the statute was passed. Which would you pull off the shelf to interpret this statute?
I think that he intends to pull the one that the legislators might have prospectively used at the time.
Okay. So you go back to what they were thinking in 1982 or 1964? I'm genuinely asking.
I mean, I would do it differently overall, but I guess that he kind of, I feel like he kind of looks back more to the original sort of perspective.
And you just use any dictionary as opposed to Black's? How many of you got Black's Law Dictionary when you got admitted to law school? It used to be the gift. It was like getting a Parker or Cross pen when you graduate from high school. No? It's all online now. Sad. Okay. So why not use a legal dictionary as opposed to Merriam-Webster's?
I think it's because he thinks ordinary meaning is what an English speaker would understand rather than kind of what a specific expert might look at for a specific kind of definition, because a legal definition and legalese might be different than what a person on the street would know.
Okay.
So I think that when he looks at ordinary meaning, he's kind of seeing just what a regular, reasonable, kind of like a reasonable person standard is towards kind of what they would think of the word representative, because they're the ones reading the statute. They're the ones who have to interpret it.
Okay. So it's context driven. In some cases, ordinary may make sense, in which case you read in Webster's. In others, maybe the specialized legal definition seems to be implied and you pull Black's. Does that make sense? Okay. Now I assume now if you pull the dictionary off the shelf, there's 10 definitions oftentimes for every word. How do you choose which one? I was waiting for her to notice. Y'all know what this is, don't you? The Oxford English Dictionary. This is the authoritative resource for every word in the English language. It details every word's etymological roots and historical usage going back to Middle English. So,